It's Friday, the 7th of August. Good morning, and thank you for being with us for our roundtable panel on this Friday. And it's very nice to have you with us. We've been waiting for you. We've been here since about 7 a.m., and we were just waiting for you. And now you're here, and that's good. Let me introduce our panel. I don't know if that works, Rosemary. Let me. Have to turn up everybody's headphones here this morning. We didn't do this in our sound check. Let me welcome our panel, and then I will welcome our listeners to call. No, to write to us. Well, for God's sakes, don't call us. Write to us. That's much better. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Making up the group this morning, WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. I can hardly look straight. We were up till 12 o'clock at night, which was bad for me because we went to see Emmanuel Axe, Leonidas Kavakos, and Yo-Yo Ma at Tanglewood. It was worth it. But today I'm the Walking Dead.
But worth it, right?
Place was packed. Everybody was there. The lawn was filled, and that was at the smaller theater. You know, at the
Ozawa Hall,
and the Ozawa, of course, and it was some happening. Whoa!
Now, see, I thought you were up late because I was also up till 12 o'clock because I did the debate with the debate final John Stewart Quinella, and
wow.
That kept me up till midnight. So
wow.
Yeah. But it seems like you probably had more fun.
I did, and then I watched the debate.
Okay.
After that, right.
So then we also welcome investigative reporter and University at Albany journalism professor Rosemary Armeo.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
Wonderful to have you here. And Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussville joins us this morning. Hello, sir.
Good morning. Nice to see you. I did not make the full Quinella. I recorded the second race of the Quinella, so
yes.
I'll be watching that one later.
It is... It's very nicely done,
yeah.
I think. Very, very nicely done. Well, let's start off and talk about the debate. I have to say, it was quite 2 hours of television last night, and it is there were so many emotions that I had while watching it. I'm curious what the panel thinks. It seems to me it's one of those things, and this is for all three of you, but it was one of those events that seemed like there was just so much happening that you couldn't even keep up with all of the storylines that were coming out of that thing.
Mm-hmm. It was great television.
I watched a lot of the run-up to the debates on all the cable news channels,
yeah.
and was getting aggravated because it was being touted, I thought, way out of proportion as entertainment and as a circus and all the rest. And then I watched it and I found that it exceeded all of that. It was a circus. It was entertaining. I don't know that we learned too much about policy from the debate. I think we learned more about personalities. And the other thing that I was shocked to see, and I would say pleasantly so, and this is more so on the evening debate than the first one, which I also watched. But let's give Fox News credit. They did not throw softballs at these people. They were throwing hard, pointed, difficult questions, and who would have thunk it?
I winced. I mean, they started off right with the pledge, mm-hmm. and I thought, man, the pledge asking all the candidates to pledge of not going to remain a Republican to support the nominee
mm-hmm.
and not to go off in a third-party candidate. Of course, Donald Trump was the only one who decided he would not take that pledge. And then you're right. I mean, I just from there, it was very pointed questions. And I figured, as in most debate formats, it would be, here is a question about immigration, and then all of them will answer it instead of very pointed questions to each individual candidate, which, quite frankly, mm-hmm. I thought was very effective.
Well, it was interesting that Ben Carson got the race question. But
yes.
While Trump complained that he was treated particularly harshly, that didn't seem to me to be true. Kasich got asked about why'd you agree to go on to Obamacare when you're supposed
yeah.
to be against it. That's a pretty hard question. They all had. You were right. I thought they did a great job.
I mean, there was very little. There was very little debating. You know, because as Joe points out, you expected one question would be answered by all, but that they didn't have that format. So it was largely just an individual interview kind of thing with every once in a while somebody would try to play off one another.
Yeah.
Well, there were a couple of debates or duels.
Many debates.
With Christie, for example.
Yeah. Rand Paul seems ticked.
Wow.
He's just angry.
Angry man.
Yeah. What were you saying, Alan?
Well, I was thinking that you guys are all wrong. Especially Rosemary. I mean, to me,
I hardly even talked yet.
it was enough. I on the other hand, thought that the Fox was up to no good. I don't think they were playing it fair at all. And I thought that Trump was right. I don't like Trump, but I think he was right. I think the agenda item there was to get rid of Trump. The question that they asked, the way that they talked to him, I thought he was right. I think they decided he was bad for the party. He would not win the election, and they decided he was going to be the one whose behind got kicked.
Boy,
and
I think they
did it effectively.
I think you could make the case that they were looking to get rid of any of those people. I thought that they went after. It seems to me that they took the obvious weakness that was sort of the elephant in the room for every candidate,
and asked a question directly
about it.
Immigration of Jeb Bush, for example. Every one of them, I can think of at least one question
gay marriage with Kasich.
Exactly. That would get them in trouble.
See, I think if in fact they do get to a general election, their best candidate is Jeb Bush. And that was evidenced last night by the kinds of things he said on things like immigration. So that while the pundits were all over the place, if this was a horse race, let me put it this way, we still don't know who won.
Alan, my turn to disagree. Jeb Bush was decidedly mediocre last night. He made no mistakes, but he had no fire, no passion. He stumbled a lot. He spoke it stuttering. He paled in comparison to his one-time mentee, Rubio, who I don't like, and yet he came off very well. And John Kasich was the star as far as being the moderate.
I don't agree with virtually anything that any of them said,
right.
But if I was going to say who looks like they're good candidates out of this field, I would mention Rubio, I'd mention Kasich, Walker to a slightly less degree.
Same with him. I think he came off even worse than Bush. Again, no big mistake, but no statements of... Mm-hmm. Even Christie had more life than Walker did.
But their big mistake was too far to the right. In other words, they've got to win an election here. And while you guys are saying, well, their personality came through and their articulation came through, also their right-wingedness in a society which is decidedly split, but has more Democrats than Republicans. You know, we all said, okay, that guy's funny. That guy beat him up. That guy did this. But in fact, if you listen to what they were saying, it wasn't a winning message for the American people.
No, I agree with.
That's what I say. I don't agree with virtually anything I heard last night. But it also seems to me that this first debate was very much needed to be personality driven. You're not going to get all that much substance between these 10 people and the other 7 people, and still the field has narrowed down to about 5 or 6 of them. And by that time, we'll know their personalities better, and we won't be thinking as much about their personalities as we will about what they have to say. Now, I don't think any of them will ultimately say anything that's going to make a Democrat want to vote for them, but we will learn by then who is perhaps more presidential and who we perhaps feels more strongly about supporting, and I think last night was a stepping off point for that.
Let us talk about, of course, the story is that if you look at one of the things in the coverage last night, the New York Times, I think, did a wonderful job of live tweeting and also doing their coverage on their site of saying, well, look, this is how many minutes each candidate got per break and per commercial break, let's say, for the section, and how much time did each candidate speak and then totaling that time up. And, of course, no surprise, the person who spoke most was Donald Trump. And I thought, in reading tweets and reading my favorite tweet of the night was, I'm glad to see that Fox hired the producers of Maury for this particular debate. I like that. But to me, that idea of especially at the beginning of the debate, because everyone thought that, well, maybe Trump would be on good behavior and would not do, but he certainly did his Trump thing.
He did that whole Rosie O'Donnell thing. That was disgusting. That was one of my favorite tweets. Rosie O'Donnell said, "How do you explain this to the kids?"
Yeah,
that was ridiculous. And my second favorite one came from Kim Kardashian, who had a selfie of herself with Hillary Clinton because they had all been at a Clinton fundraiser that night. So Hillary is projecting how she just didn't really.
Was she facing the camera?
Yeah, they were both. Yeah, it was Hillary with Kim hair, and she wasn't showing her butt. No.
You know what Trump said about women obviously is misogynistic, is abhorrent, and all the rest. So I don't want to sound like I'm defending him, but it was pure Trump that he did. I'm sure he thought this is going to be a funny throwaway line, and that's what he has been known for. I mean, again, I heard him on the Today Show this morning, and they were talking about how his poll numbers are great. But the Fox News focus group right after the debate was not nearly as favorable. So he immediately goes after Frank, Frank Luntz, calling him Frank Dunce, and said that he came to me looking for a job. I mean, it was his typical.
And Megyn Kelly, they obviously went after her.
That's the fallback.
Yeah, bullying Megyn Kelly. And then I paid Hillary to come to my wedding.
Yeah.
What? I mean, aside from the insult to Hillary, which of course was intended, but he buys politicians. Wow, I want him for president.
And then Twitter immediately had pictures of the marriage with the Clintons there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my favorite tweet was. I'm sorry, Alan.
Go ahead, Alan.
No, that's okay. No, I thought Trump was right about that panel afterwards. I thought he was right. That was led in a way, once again, to show that Trump was a dunce. And I switched. I just thought it was predictable and it happened.
Well, he was the front runner by a long shot, so he should have been the target, although I can't really see that he got singled out for any special heart attack.
Oh, yeah, he did.
I think you could look. I mean, that question of Ben Carson at the beginning that was a shot. I don't know. I saw all of their questions to be quite frank and in some cases brutal.
Yeah.
And as I said, there were a couple wince moments like, wow, did they really ask that? Mm-hmm. To me, the most awkward, and Ira, you probably watch this, but that first 10 minutes of when they, because they started at,
I don't know why they did it that way.
Yeah. What they did is they just ran sort of a live C-SPAN feed from about 8:45 to 9 o'clock of them priming the audience, and they obviously weren't on prompter. They were just talking. Nobody made sense. The candidates just looked befuddled, and it was really awkward.
Yeah, it was what you would normally see before the cameras are turned on. A lot of small talk and how are you guys? Are you nervous? The afternoon, what do they call it, the happy hour debate, was even worse in many respects. First of all, the questions in the happy hour debate I thought were not nearly as tough, and they were more leading them on to places they wanted to go. But to your point, it was like watching, Good Morning Sacramento with the Martha McCallum and I think his name is Bill Hemmer. That duo just made it feel like you were in a television studio. And with, by the way, almost nobody in the seats behind them.
Right.
That was very bizarre. I thought that particular debate. But Fiorina, in my view, clearly stepped up, and we may see her on the main stage the next time.
Well, as
but the rest are gone. I mean, you have Rick Perry. He did not help himself in the loser debate. I think most of those candidates are now effectively
eliminated.
Well,
I watch these things, and I'm going to rely on Alan's opinion here, because even though he never relies on mine, but I watch these people, and I look at
that's not true.
Well, I look at a George Pataki, and I say, why is he here? I mean, he's he's a nice enough fellow. No matter what you thought of him as the governor of New York, he can't be there for any other reason, as can others, unless they're running for vice president or they're running for a cabinet position. And they obviously
or
know
because,
that.
Or because the fickle finger of fate has once landed on them, of fame, and they just can't live without it. It's like
it.
Your first sexual experience. Once you do it, that's it. And I think that's what's happened. I think that's what's happened to Pataki. I do.
That was a Trumpian answer.
Yeah, so?
That's why they're all smoking
We got some mail.
All right.
From Claude. The Donald, please, please, please run as an independent. That would assure Hillary being our next president, as he'd most likely split the Republican vote. Just worry about Bernie running as an independent hurting Hillary. What is most troubling about this election and others, the U.S. voters generally are pretty dumb. It would be nice if voters on both sides were better informed. That's Claude from Albany. But let me just say that Bernie has told me and told everybody that he will not run as a third-party candidate. That's very different from what the Donald is doing right now. And then from Bob in Albany, Kasich doesn't have the financial or party establishment backing to be a presidential nominee, but he's a very strong contender for VP, and that could easily tilt Ohio into the Republican column. And this is Alan speaking. We all know that no Republican has ever won without Ohio, and so that means something. And those are, I think, very interesting letters, don't you?
Absolutely. And you made this point, but I think Kasich came out very, very. I mean, he was also in a hometown crowd. They really
supported him a lot, but he did do well.
He did very well.
He was calm and reasonable, even compassionate, for a Republican.
Let's take a break. We will catch up with some of the business we have to catch up with, and then we'll come back and continue with other items of news, because there are some. Roundtable at WAMC.org if you'd like to share your thoughts. Roundtable at WAMC.org, and we will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Ira Fussfeld. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Alan, you have some mail you want to get to?
Well, there isn't much, because I think we got to the other stuff.
You're
saying something. Here's one that is interesting. As a Republican operative, the last thing he wants is a Trump. Roger Ailes is the subject. As a Republican operative, the last thing he wants is a Trump presidency. I am certain that the first question concerning a third party was his idea. That was interesting, right?
Yeah.
Certainly he is the big man, at Fox. Will somebody responsible at the roundtable kindly relieve Alan from mangling our emails on the air? Okay, so thank you very much. Criticism is very good for the soul. And we always read criticism if it's within the bounds of good taste, which, frankly, that wasn't, but okay.
You let it go, that's why.
Anyway, the problem was I was in the middle of the first sentence, because I don't pre-read them, when I realized this guy was up to no good. So I figured I had to finish it. Okay, so that's what I got.
There was a fascinating story in the New York Times, I guess it was yesterday, where they had access to Fox planning the debate. I mean, to Alan's point about Roger Ailes, and they had many, many meetings to really plot it out. But one of the meetings was chaired by Roger Ailes. And so as I was reading it, thinking, how many organizations at that level of organization does the big guy actually come downstairs to chair the meeting? So he was very hands-on on this. Mm-hmm.
Let us go to the other thing. That as I was watching the debate last night across the screen and in my breaking news box was Chuck Schumer says I'm not going to support the Iran deal. And so The timing of that I thought was interesting too. Just that it was announced at that moment and came across during the Republican debate. But it certainly was. I think both Senator, we talked about this last week, both Senators Gillibrand and Schumer had not committed. And then last night, Chuck Schumer came out and said that he was not going to support the Iran deal.
Alan, Gillibrand said she would.
Yes,
and
she would. Yesterday.
Yes. So
don't think those two haven't talked to each other because right. They are really very close. So here's the deal. Chuck Schumer is running for re-election and Gillibrand is not. There's a huge group of people in New York, Jewish population and others, who are very, very worried about Israel. And Schumer knows that this is a game changer for him. So he did politically what he had to. I'm not happy with it, but I understand what he's doing. And he'll be the head guy. If the Democrats take the Senate, he's going to be the head guy. He'll be the new Harry Reid. But you first, the old saying in politics is first you got to get elected. And that's what's going on here.
This is not the first time Schumer has gone against the president, and in the very short period when he's been the leader, he also did not vote for the Pacific Trade Pact. I'd be a little bit leery of him if I were the Obama. On the other hand, I do think this was a personal decision. I don't think he just put his finger to the wind and said, I have to do this. I think he knows the bill. He went all through it. He spent a lot of time with both Obama and the negotiators and reached a personal decision. The question will be whether he steps out of the way or whether he tries to convince others to also vote no.
That was what I was going to ask you. I mean, do you just say, I'm personally going to vote no, or do you become an active force to try to get others to come with you on that?
To stop the bill.
Well, let me tell you something. I think, and I apologize to the senator if what I'm going to say is incorrect, but I believe that he announced this via a press release or some low-key method of doing it. As Joe pointed out, it was announced around 10 o'clock last night. Chuck Schumer is not one to shy away from the microphones. Mm-hmm. He is not one to shy away from cameras. And the fact that he announced this in the middle of a Republican debate that he well knew everybody was going to be talking about, that was today's big story, was going to be the Republican debate. Although he may have shown a level of courage in making a decision that was no doubt a very wrenching one for him, I think that the way he announced it was cowardly. If he's going to make a decision as momentous as this is, and it is significant, as Rosemary points out, he is the leader of the Democrats mowing forward. His voice is very important on matters regarding Israel. For him to make this announcement as he did was very surprising and, as I say, very cowardly.
Well, a couple of things. One, the fact that Gillibrand comes out and says she's going to vote for it means that there's been some discussion, and I think answers your first question, Ira, that he is not going to be pushing people around. If he wanted to push her around, he would have pushed her around. The second thing is a matter of courage. You know, when he voted for the Iraq war, you know where he did it, right? You know where he made that announcement. He did it at the Linda Norris Auditorium. He came out and he faced what he knew were going to be a group of very tough adversaries, and were, one of whom threw hot coffee on me, I'll never forget it, and were really and really showed remarkable courage for a very unpopular decision among many of his constituents. But I thought it was courageous for him to do it. I'm not willing to write him off as being a coward, that's for sure.
It is extremely interesting what's happening within the Democratic Party now on this issue. I think Obama gave a very certainly passionate but also smart speech about why this was a measure worth supporting. And he does want and needs the support of Democrats to get it through. This is not like the trade pact where he could do it with Republicans only.
I have a feeling they've counted heads. And
I think
that
close,
Schumer
though.
felt that he was safe to stand to have it cake and eat it also.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're right. I think it's really close, though.
Mm-hmm. So, Alan, I know you've got some letters on Schumer.
We do. Well, yes, we do. Bonnie says, "Dear panel, Chuck provided us with a profile, in quotes, in the opposite of courage, self-serving at the expense of the best that could be achieved, getting reelected, trumped all else." And that's from Bonnie. Okay. And then we heard from Richard, who said, "I'll never vote for him again. A profile in cowardice. Trade his integrity for votes." And then I guess that's it, Joe, unless you see something that I don't see.
I thought there were more.
Really?
Do you see the one... let's see.
Exciting radio.
Well, anyway, it doesn't
matter.
There's
one from Harold in Rhinebeck, and Harold said, "Another debate in a long and grueling presidential campaign. Prime Minister Stephen Harper of Canada recently called federal elections. It seems interesting. It'll be the longest campaign in Canada for over a century. 11 weeks. U.S. presidential campaigns go on for so long that people simply lose interest." And Jill says, "Good morning, panel. I was very disappointed when I heard this morning that Schumer will vote against the Iranian deal. I realize he's Jewish and he's very pro-Israel, but doesn't he understand that it could be worse for Israel without the deal? Do you folks on the panel think that many other Democrats will follow his lead?" And I think that remains to be seen. But I think, as Ira just indicated, they've counted votes and they know they haven't got enough to put a stop to this. But who knows?
You know, I haven't been here when you people, no doubt, on the prior shows have talked about this deal. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this point has been raised. But I for the life of me, this is a deal that was agreed to by major countries, our allies from around the world in Europe. Yeah. And it appears that the only place that this deal is being questioned and is being vilified is in the United States Congress.
That is true.
And I don't know what that says about...
And in Israel.
Right. Yes,
good
I'm
point,
sorry.
Alan.
Yeah. It gives you reason for pause, I guess, is the right way. What do we see in the Congress, or they see in the Congress, that they don't see in Germany or in other countries that did support this deal?
The president, well, his Ken, speech attacked that. I'm sorry, Alan. The president attacked that.
No, I was just going to say, yeah.
Go ahead.
Ken says, Chuck's siding with Bibi and against Obama? Clear where his loyalties lie. Look for a deserved primary challenge, says Ken. We heard from Jim, who said, "I don't trust the man. He supported the Iraq war because he believed it would benefit Israel and never apologized for that vote. Since the traitor Pollard was convicted for treason, he worked with Israel for his release, almost always sided with Netanyahu when there was a disagreement with the Obama administration, and pressured fellow Democrats to attend the Netanyahu show in Congress earlier this year." And there you go.
And Rosemary, were
no,
you
no,
gonna...
no, no.
Are you done?
Fine. I'm done.
Okay. Let's take a break. We'll be back and continue with our discussion. We welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Beacon Fine Art Printing, Beacon, offering museum-quality G-Clay printing, scanning, retouching, mounting, and fine art reproduction for galleries, artists, photographers, and collectors. BeaconFineArtPrinting.com. Field Goods, providing year-round deliveries of produce from local farms for pickups at workplaces or community sites and offering workplace wellness programs. Fresh food from small farms, field-goods.com. Curran Compliance Services, Greenwich, New York, and now in St. Paul, Minnesota, national compliance and regulatory consultants for the life insurance industry, currancompliance.com. And Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, Saratoga, New York, featuring a children's section with toys, games, activities, and clothing, northshire.com.
My headphones. Good morning. Welcome back to the to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We certainly welcome your thoughts. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Let us move on to some other issues. And there are other issues. And, well, first of all, was I the only one? But I thought the Stradivarius story was fascinating.
I love that story. Love that story.
Amazing story. Did you see that, Alan?
I did, and it's not the first time that that kind of thing has happened.
Nina Totenberg who found it.
Well, I know. Actually, what happened was that the miscreant left the locked violin for his wife. She managed to get the thing open, brought it to a violin guy who knew his stuff, who would appraise it, who immediately called the FBI. He said, "This has been stolen for 35 years." And then they called the Totenberg women, the three sisters, who have very, very interestingly said, "We'll sell it all right, but we're going to only sell it to a great performer." And again and again, people leave Stradivariuses in the back of cars. They leave them unguarded in their rooms at Carnegie Hall while they're going on. And it's just an amazing story and a wonderful story. Of course.
I predict. This is
all right.
Yes. What's his name? The mentalist.
Kreskin.
By perhaps next summer or the summer thereafter, both Alan and Joe are going to be holding that very Stradivarius in their arms when whatever big time musician gets it and it plays at Tanglewood, and we will play it at
Joshua
Tanglewood.
Joshua Bell had the same thing happen to him. He's playing, I believe it's the great Huberman Stradivarius, which was stolen out of his Carnegie Hall office. And again, the guy dies, leaves it to the wife. The wife gets it one way or another, gets it back, and they sell it to Bell, and he's playing it to this day.
So just real quick to give background on the story. So this rare 281-year-old Stradivarius violin stolen in 1980 from a musician and teacher has been found, according to Nina Totenberg, the NPR legal affairs correspondent and daughter of the late violinist Roman Totenberg. The prized Strad, crafted by Stradivarius in 1734, disappeared after a performance by Totenberg in 1980 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And then at the U.S. Attorney General's, the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York City, the instrument will be returned today to the three daughters. Nina Totenberg declined to speculate on its value, though a Stradivarius violin sold for more, the similar Strad sold for $15 million in 2011.
Okay, so my interest is in the guy who stole it. It was a young musician. Mm-hmm. Totenberg suspected him, although didn't have enough proof to get the police to go search his stuff. But he had this beautiful, amazing instrument for 35 years, it's been. Couldn't have played it in public. Did he play it at home? Did his wife really not know about it? And Totenberg plainly is suspicious of the wife when she talked about the wife claims with her boyfriend. Totenberg adds, with her boyfriend, she finally gets the box open and then brings the violin in. So I would love to know the real story of this. Why did he steal a Stradivarius and then hide it away for 35 years?
Well, you know, if you think about it, that's what happens with great art also. People steal pictures, and they take them and they put them in their basement and they go down every night and they look at the picture. And they don't want the rest of the world to see what they could have in a museum.
But the Stradivarius is sound. It is hiding it away. It's not like looking at a picture like the Nazi art collectors who put them up in their dark apartments and love to look at them. You can't use it.
I would respectfully disagree with you. It's an OJ dart. I mean, it is an artistic thing in itself, and possession of it is just like possession of a great work of art.
It didn't even have strings.
Yeah, it didn't. I know.
Didn't even have strings. It is a fascinating story. We got to have a couple of letters, and then we'll have time for one more topic, I believe, Alan.
Okay, so Gray says there's a third major antagonist to the Iran deal. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard is firmly against it. The great fear that they have is that the moderates in Iran who worked out the deal will wrest power from their radical organization. Well, I'm no fan, Grace, of the Republican Guard. Revolutionary Guard, that is for sure. However, I have to tell you that the Ayatollah himself, who is no shrinking violet or liberal, came out for the deal. So I don't think that the Revolutionary Guard are in a position or going to be able to stop it, because their leader, the guy who put it all together, is in fact in charge. So I don't know about that. Don says of the Iran nuclear deal, those countries geographically closest to Iran are the most concerned: Israel, Saudi Arabia, etc. This proximity is a cause for skepticism. The U.S., Russia, China, Germany, France, and England have the luxury of distance. I understand the concern of Israel in the Arab states. However, I see no credible alternative to the deal. And then Denise says, I'm not at all surprised that Senator Schumer is supporting Mr. Netanyahu, but given that Mr. Netanyahu has aligned himself so closely with the Republican Party, I do not believe that Mr. Schumer is the best person to lead the Democratic Party. While it's regrettable our country has become polarized like Mr. Netanyahu, Mr. Schumer has taken a side he must be held accountable for and the consequences. And then... We have heard, I'm reading as we go, from Ken, the insurance company, now the only injured party left the room, has what legal standing claim they paid out? So the insurance company, apparently, as I read the story, Joe, you'll correct me, I'm sure, if I'm wrong, gave the insurance was about $100,000, and that's being given back to the insurance company, and they have agreed that it should go to the Totenbergs. Is that right?
My understanding, yes.
Yes. No strings attached.
And that's funny.
Very good.
That is really good. Yeah, it is. And Scott says, it doesn't work with Alan being remote. What remote? Okay. And then this is from Anonymous. All right. It is my understanding that a small majority of American Jews support the president on the Iran issue. How would that square with Schumer's decision to oppose? Let's see. And then Tom says, Alan et al., I haven't been able to listen to the entire show, but so far I haven't heard anything about what I regard was the outrageous question to all presidential pretenders last night. Has God spoken to you? Pretty scary.
Yeah.
Let's see. I guess that's it.
I agree about the God question, though. There was a lot of internet chatter about that, how the founding fathers would be rolling in their graves.
Yeah, that was the one question that I felt that the Fox panelists pandered to the far right.
That's the one I think Roger Ailes put in. Mm.
That was the contribution
that's
during the meeting?
The God question, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I also wanted to say that one of the big audiences is for all the debate and the Sturm und Drang over the Iran deal is the Iranian public. They are fascinated with it. They're getting a lesson in how democracy works. And they have a lot at stake at it, too. So they're hanging on every word being written about this.
People have a right to be wary about making a deal with Iran for all the reasons that they're wary about it. And I'm not the first one to say this. When you're making a diplomatic negotiation and reaching a pact such as this, you're doing it by its very, very definition with an enemy.
Right.
And you're taking a chance.
Right.
And there were pacts after wars.
Absolutely.
You've got to, you know, what is the alternative?
The bottom line to me, Obama said it was the U.S. military and he then quoted how much bigger ours is than Iran, is the final arbiter. If there is a problem, we still have that. The pact does not take away the might of the American military. So.
By the way, didn't you find it interesting last night that two or three of the candidates were citing what they felt was a weakness in the U.S. military? The numbers are down.
Really,
and things
really,
of that
yeah.
Sort.
Yeah.
Leah says, I'm furious that your thrust about Israel, Schumer, Iran deal is all about Jewish security. Iran is an avowed enemy of the United States. The damage they could do to us is overwhelming. It's only about, repeat, it's not only about Israel. Congratulations, Chuck Schumer, for taking the correct action. That's from Leah.
It's true. Iran is extremely dangerous, but they have a nuclear weapon, and they're even more dangerous. That's what this is attempting to prevent.
We have we just have about 3 minutes. I just want to quickly mention the story, New York City story. The city is ordering tests of water cooling towers amid Legionnaires outbreak. The mayor announced on Thursday that building owners will be required to assess and clean water cooling towers. And it seems like, well, a scary story.
Yeah, it is.
The right thing to do, though. I mean, you know, if 9 people die, I think that's what it's up to now in the Bronx. And they can find the disease, they can find the organisms in the water on these water towers, then every water tower has to be inspected, no question. If anybody's been in New York lately, you know that the biggest business in New York is putting netting around buildings so that bricks don't fall down. And as I have often said, every law, every rule comes because one thing happened. And then you have to be prudent, and that's exactly what the mayor is doing right now. It'll be a popular move, I think.
Legionnaires is such a mysterious, spooky disease. I remember when the first outbreak happened in Philadelphia.
And
it was because of the conference of
lived in Philadelphia at that point, and it was scary stuff.
But it is treatable. It has symptoms that once you recognize you have them, you can go and take antibiotics, and you should be all right.
And after they mentioned those symptoms last night, how many of us at this had them?
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. I'll tell you what, they were some of the instances were relatively close to Yankee Stadium, and I was thinking, are there any of the 50,000 people at the ball game sitting there afraid to buy a hot dog because they might get Legionnaires' disease?
Yes.
Or with the hot dogs, a stomach ache.
Right. Maybe they're just afraid to eat one of the hot dogs. Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Rosemary Armeo, thank you very much for being with us this morning. Always a pleasure. Alan, have a great weekend.
Okay, guys.
Thank you.
And to all of you, wonderful weekend.
All right. Rosemary, thank you very much.
Yes.
My pleasure.
And Ira, thanks for making the trek up. I appreciate it.
See you next week.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.